Relentless Roger and the Caveman Doctor, Episode 11. Today, Dr. Champ and I recap wheat addiction and sprints and attempt to answer the following questions. Are artificial sweeteners any better than sugar? How trustworthy are fitness product ads? And what is your protein powder doing to your insulin? Roger and the Caveman Doctor, Episode 11. I am Roger, here with Dr. Champ. What's up, man?
Not a lot. It's a good feeling to be done with a decade of posts here, of
That's
podcasts.
Right.
Now everything's going well. I leave this week, actually, for Vail for a week to do my ketogenic trial.
That's great.
So yeah, I'm pretty happy about that. And then just getting pumped for Ancestral Health, which Roger and I will be going to. It's, what, the 12th? Around August 12th.
9th to the 12th.
9th to the 12th.
Yep.
We'll be spending a weekend together. You know, I love this hour or so that we take, but a whole weekend, I don't know what I'm going to do.
So if there's ever a risk for this podcast, you know, breaking up and never continuing, it's after we get sick of each other
yeah, exactly.
In Boston.
1 hour good, a weekend too much.
Yeah.
Interesting, just a real quick anecdote. They have this website where you can go on and everyone who's going to the conference is listed. So there's these big name people like Gary Taub, Rob Wolf, and you can click, if you're friends with them, you can click one to meet. And I had a couple people click that they wanted to meet me, and it's really a flattering thing. So I started clicking some people, and I actually clicked Taub and some of these really big names, and I'm sure they're not going to respond to me. But I also clicked one, Roger Dickerman, and I said, hey, Roger, love the show. You're great. The other guy's okay. Really would love to meet you at the Ancestral Health Symposium. No response. Not even a laugh back, just dead silence.
Dude, I don't have time for that nonsense.
Anyway,
well, of course I want to meet you, man.
I guess we won't be meeting. Anyway,
right, now as silly as it is, I'm actually going to have to log on to this system that I haven't been on in months, just to come back and say I want to meet you too.
Yeah,
man.
People are going to be confused. that's pretty much all that's going on with me. What's up with you?
So we got a great shout out this week.
That's right.
The Fat to Fit guy. So it's Fat to Fit HQ, I think, is their official title. Zach and Jake. So Jimmy Moore turned us on to this and mentioned that we got a mention. So we checked it out and I enjoyed the show.
Good stuff.
They brought up some interesting points. I think one of them is looking to possibly go down Paleo Road, while the other one of them is looking to possibly go down the slow carb, 4 hour body Tim Ferriss approach. And I actually suggested in the comments, why not do a dueling diets? I think that's really compelling. And nice. It sounds like there's some traction for the idea. It would be really, really interesting.
Absolutely.
Because I have no doubts that in the short term, both of those approaches would get pretty solid results.
Yeah.
So if one does one does the other, we'll see.
I like it.
Maybe we'll be able to do something with those guys in the future.
Absolutely.
That'd be great. See how their progress continues to go. So Zach and Jake, thank you so much for the shout out. Best of luck with everything. And I think the feeling's mutual. We really, really would like to see you do that dueling diet piece.
Roger and I will do dueling something else. We haven't figured it out yet.
we're not dueling, but we'll be working together very, very, very soon.
Very soon. Yeah, absolutely. Roger and I are giving a talk at the local Jefferson Hospital, which is actually right across the street. It is titled, what do we talk? Tangible Takeaways for Fat Loss.
Yep.
And it's just kind of going to be exactly that, about an hour of us bantering about ways to actually lose fat, tangible ways to do it, avoiding foods that won't let you get to that goal. And I think I'm going to go first for about a half hour, talk about some of the data. And then once everyone's bored out of their minds, Roger's just going to
wake them up,
tear in and go to town. So look forward to that.
It should be good, man. Relentless Roger and the Caveman Doctor taking things on the road.
Yeah.
I'd like to do more of that. Yeah,
absolutely. It's only the beginning.
Only the beginning. So hopefully we'll be coming to a location near you in Philadelphia and then beyond. But you know, I'm pretty thrilled. I say this sometimes. I'm pretty thrilled about the two of us being able to come together and just bring those angles together in the middle. You know, the medicine you're spot on the science. Your articles are supremely well referenced.
Thanks.
And you're just bringing that great side to it. Again, more on the empirical day to day, just in those trenches, trying to take the science and make it work for people in everyday life. And I really think that we play off each other well, so that when we can go into a room like that, you know, somebody's going to get a dose of the science and the medicine. They're going to get a dose of the application, and hopefully come out of there with, like we said in the title, tangible takeaways.
Tangible takeaways. Whether they like it or not, they're going to get a dose of both.
That's right. Sweet. Well, hey, man, that's what's new. So you have an article for us, I think, building on last week a little bit.
Absolutely. So last week we discussed, is wheat addictive? And there is a decent amount of data out there pointing towards it, nothing definitive. The article which I'm discussing is called Opioid Peptides Derived from Food Proteins, the exorphins. And basically this article discusses exorphins in food, and these are basically proteins from food that have opioid activity. For those of you that know opioids, that's morphine and other highly addictive drugs that are used for pain medications. And this article just talks about all these different kind of foods and the effect they have. And most interesting to me was the fact that in these animals, they gave naloxone, which basically blocks this opioid receptor. And it reversed the stimulus that these food types have.
Wow.
So if that's not a smoking gun, I mean, this is what we give to drug addict patients to block that stimulation you get from the drugs of abuse.
So the conclusion there then being this food may really be affecting the very same pathways, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not etched in stone from this, and you know, these are animal studies, et cetera, but sure. it is a smoking gun. And
that's crazy. I mean, I think we had talked about last week, when we had gotten into wheat and addiction, and I think Dr. Champ, you said, hey, even if wheat is not technically addictive to the brain, you wouldn't be surprised to see the body showing it in some other ways.
Absolutely.
But what you're talking about today, what this pulls it back to is that, hey, certain kinds of food may be affecting the very same pathways.
Absolutely.
That, that drugs do.
Absolutely. And this is a smoking gun. The concrete for me is the breadbasket test. For those of you that have taken the breadbasket test, put 12 pieces in front of you. Maybe throw some butter and salt on it if you want to make it really, really challenging. If you can eat one of those, then maybe they're not addictive for you. But if you polish off the basket and turn into a complete monster, which I have multiple times in my life, that pretty much seals the deal for me. I don't need another experiment beyond that.
I love to look back at what life was like pre-nutritional or just fitness in general awakening for me, you know, because I'm not new to the game, but I really started diving down the nutritional and exercise rabbit hole, let's say 7-8 years ago, right? And then I've been rabid ever since. But what happened before 7 or 8 years ago? And I think back to, you know, like that breadbasket test, you know, going to a place like my first internship ever, the people there loved to go to the Cheesecake Factory, right? That was their spot. And so when you come on an internship, you're going wherever the heck the people you're working with and working for want to go. So we would always, whether it was birthdays, anything in office, we would go out to the Cheesecake Factory. And I remember destroying the Cheesecake Factory breadbasket.
Oh, yeah. The crazy thing about that is you destroy the breadbasket, and then I remember when they bring those head-sized pieces of cheesecake.
Oh, man.
Somehow I find room to just throw that in there, too.
There's always room, right?
You just went up to me. It's the breadbasket cheesecake test.
That's it.
If you can eat a whole breadbasket and then polish it off with cheesecake, you are addicted.
Yep. And it's those pathways, man.
There you go.
There's not no even, doubt about it.
It's not your fault.
Yep. It is not your fault. And I can look back at that and, you know, and I can talk about it now, man.
Yeah.
I can talk about it now.
Roger used to talk to me about it with tears flowing, but we've moved on now.
And it's a much different day. It's a much different age, and it's good to be here. You know, as much as we've talked about this before in the show, but as much as the magic has been taken out of food, you know, like a decade ago when I'm at the Cheesecake Factory polishing off that breadbasket, there's not even a hint in my mind of what will this mean later? What will this do to my body? How will this negatively affect my health. There was none of that. It was, I'm going to enjoy this piece of bread with butter slathered on it and the cheesecake and sleep it off later, you know, and then start it all over again the next day. And even though the magic has been taken out of food, I'm still very grateful, very appreciative to be at this stage, to be educated to the extent that I realize what kinds of long-term effects those things are going to have.
Yeah, just replacing that reward system with another.
Exactly.
Which I think is more rewarding in the long term.
Definitely. No doubt about it.
So what do you got for us?
So I also am going to build off of last week. We talked about your latest piece in Sprints, which was fantastic. So as you know, we are both big fans of Sprints and working that into your workouts. So I'm going to quote Dr. Briffa. So Dr. Briffa says, high-intensity intermittent exercise helps shift fat and brings many other benefits. So this is nothing new, but it's good, solid supporting evidence. He goes into a recently published study. The participants here had an average age of 25. So on the younger side, they were all overweight. They were divided into two groups. One was a non-instructed group. So they offered up the control group, and the other group was instructed on an HIIE, again, high intensity intermittent exercise regime over the course of 12 weeks. And so this looks, if you're familiar out there with Tabata intervals, the protocol here looks very much like Tabata intervals. So for those of you who don't know what they are, it's basically 20 seconds of maximal effort doing something with 10 seconds of rest after it. So it would be 20 seconds max effort, 10 seconds rest, right back on, 20 seconds max effort. Typically there would be 8 rotations through that. Through those intervals. So they did this 3 times a week, and the HIIE produced a number of significant changes. But, you know, most of these changes are stuff that you'd expect, right? If we're quoting a positive study, you'd expect weight loss, right? You'd expect some fat loss. You'd expect a reduction in waist circumference. This is no surprise. However, there is an interesting takeaway that Dr. Briffa found very interesting, and I think you will too. So common knowledge is if you want to lose fat, do long duration, low intensity activities. So for me, this evokes imagery of a boxer, you know, training for a fight and going for that hour long, super slow jog in the street, just kind of plodding along, pacing along. And I think that whether it started there, wherever it started, I think when someone wants to lose fat, they go to that kind of activity. And I'll be honest, I think there's some value. As long as you're going slow enough, I think there's a lot of value in that style activity too. But what this article suggests is the HIIE activity actually reduced carbohydrate metabolism and increased fat metabolism. To suggest that it may be as good or better at fat burning, at adapting your body, at changing your body. And I think that's new.
I mean, I'll always look at the sprinters. I always look at the sprinters and then look at the runners. And I mean, I'm totally biased, but I think the sprinters just look so much healthier.
No doubt about it.
More muscular. Otherwise, I think of Mac on Mike Tyson's punch out.
I'm going to drop some heavy stuff right now. I think this is, I'm setting myself up for failure, but I think this is a gem. Anyone who's listening to this, I want you to change the way you think about exercise, because I think if you do, it's going to bring you around to sprints even more. I think too often people look at exercise as just that exercise. In other words, if more is better. If I up my 45 minutes of exercise to an hour, I'm going to accomplish more, right? They're viewing the exercise as what happens during the exercise. What if you flipped it a little bit and looked at exercise as a stimulus, right? If you look at exercise as a stimulus, it's not so much what you're doing during the exercise as what it's promoting afterwards, right? So if you look at exercise as a stimulus, even if you're sprinting, doing Tabata intervals, doing HIIE for as short as 15 minutes, you could achieve lasting effects. You know, what's the body going to do after the exercise? If you make that flip in your mind, I think it'll bring you on board sprints a little bit more. Because I know when I talk to clients, one of the typical kickbacks is, hey, really only 6 rounds of sprints or only 8 rounds of sprint. That's it. And oftentimes someone will even come back and they'll think, hey, I'm going to show Roger, and they'll tell me, hey, I know you programmed in 8 sprints, but I did 14. And I'm looking at them like, no. You were not sprinting. You know, that's not the point. The point is that you get in and you get out and you hit it at maximal intensity, and it's going to do a lot for your body.
Yeah. And most of the studies that I've seen show that the length of exercise is what's usually proportional to injury. And obviously, if you do too intense, like, you have to have a common sense approach.
Yes.
You know, if you go into the gym and immediately walk in there and try to bench 350, you're probably going to be in trouble. But the duration is really what is proportional to damage to your heart, damage to your knees. Once your muscles give out, once your neurologic system gives out and your muscles then give out, your joints take all the blows. So
yep.
You do not want to work out your joints.
So what do you think? What do you think of that flip, man? Flip from viewing the exercise as the exercise to viewing the exercise as the stimulus to what happens afterwards.
I love it. I thought so much about all those studies that show these marathon runners how they have fibrosis of their heart, they have cardiac remodeling, and they have dysfunction pumping blood. That along your lines is what it's showing. So you're getting your heart rate up during the exercise. You're beating up your heart pretty thoroughly. But look what it's causing. It's just causing damage. Just like going in the gym and training to a ridiculous amount and hurting your joints with weights or whatnot. It's the same thing. The goal is the long term.
Yep.
And physique's obviously a big part of it, but the goal is long term. And even along the lines of physique, if you go in the gym and you're always hurting yourself, you're not going to look good because you're going to be sitting on your butt on the couch half the time.
Yep. And I'm just going down the list in my mind. I'm trying to think of an injury that a client has discussed with me that has been in someone who has not really kicked up their endurance activities. Yeah. I think most of the injuries I see can be directly tied to that pounding.
Yeah.
And that when that pounding is lessened, you'll see the same oft injured person all of a sudden become, for the most part, healthy and whole.
Yeah. In the gym, I push myself to places I didn't think I can go. Then playing basketball in triple overtime, I jump up and land on my leg normal way and break my leg and tear my ACL. I mean, it's an N=1, but personally, those chronic just pounding is the only time I see myself getting injured.
Yeah, absolutely. And the tough stuff is it's that nagging knee, ankle, foot stuff that it hinders what you want to do on an everyday basis. It makes you want to be less active. And a lot of times it's tough for long-term results. Cause if you get beat up like that, you move less, puts more of a burden on having perfect nutrition. A lot of times that breaks down too. And it just is a nasty snowball.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's move on.
Moving on.
You have something new to bring to the table.
I do. I've got a handful of questions about artificial sweeteners. In the last 3 weeks, I've gotten a lot of them. And I guess we've kind of touched on the saccharin last week being potentially more addictive and higher reward than cocaine. So
yep.
I'm sure that's a lot of the reason why. So artificial sweeteners. So easy for me to sit here and chastise them. So before I get into that, I just want to go over a study from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And in this study, it's called Sucrose Compared with Artificial Sweeteners, Different Effects on Ad Libitum Food Intake and Body Weight After 10 Weeks of Supplementation in Overweight Subjects. And in this study, basically, your typical one diet versus the other. They did a sucrose-heavy diet, so that's just a sugar-heavy diet, versus a artificial sweetener-heavy diet. So they replaced that with artificial sweeteners. And they showed that the artificial sweetener-heavy diet resulted in significant decreases in body weight and fat mass versus the sugar diet, which to a degree is what we expect. But also what it shows is the ad libitum intake, which is just your general how much you eat, is actually decreased in some of these patients. So whereas we know you eat carbohydrates, you eat sugars, it makes you eat more food. We know that it makes your blood sugar go up and down. It makes you hungry. The insulin release makes it hungry as well.
Sure.
And a lot of people thought that if you put people on artificial sweeteners, it's going to do the same thing. This study shows that such a diet may not do that. So there may be benefit, especially to kickstart people into a weight loss phase. There is definitely a benefit and a place for artificial sweeteners, and it would be hard to argue against that.
Yep.
Am I promoting their usage? No, but for some people, like I said, it may make sense. Counter to that is the issue of, do they cause cancer? I get a lot of questions about brain cancer and sweeteners and saccharin. And so then I'll talk about another study where they did look at, it's epidemiology, it's cancer epidemiology, biomarkers and prevention. And they looked at aspartame-containing beverages and showed an increased incidence of hematologic or hematopoietic, so blood cancers, and brain malignancies. And this study actually was met with a lot of criticism. And this study is showing that it may lead to cancer, but there are an equal number, if not more, studies showing that there's no increase in cancer at all. However, in mice, there are plenty of studies showing that these artificial sweeteners do cause cancer. And one very thorough study, they looked at lifespan exposure to low doses of aspartame, beginning during prenatal life. And they showed an increase in cancer to even low dose, and it was a basically proportional to dose. So the higher dose you got, the more cancer there was. And they did this because the initial studies back in the, I think it was 60s and 70s, that looked at a lot of these sweeteners. They did them in mice and they were 110 days. So they said these studies were not long enough at all.
Sure.
They looked from the day the mouse was born. They increased, they put all kind of crazy doses, and they showed basically a linear response. The more you got, the higher risk of cancer you get. So, you know, along these lines, depending on how you look at it, if you would put it in what's called a linear no threshold model, that basically means the smallest amount can cause cancer. So just like radiation in our society, any small amount can cause it. And once again, this is met with criticism because we don't have this kind of data in humans. I don't think we ever will, unless we take a study of two groups, put one on no sweetener and put one on a high amount of sweetener.
Sure.
That would give us the result, but that's definitely not ethical.
So let's just double back here real quick. The first study, that's the pro side to the sweeteners, showed that if you compare people consuming sweeteners to people consuming sugar, the sweetener group won out.
They improved.
Exactly. Less fat. Okay. Then the other side, the con, some of these studies, granted they're controversial, but some of these studies showed that in mice especially, that the incidences of cancer and brain tumors went up with sweetener consumption.
Yeah, so you have to do a balance. I mean, being obese and overweight is definitely not a good thing. And so I understand when people say we need to avoid that by all costs. Obviously, the goal is to avoid both. I mean, minimize your risk of getting cancer or something along those lines, and also minimizing your risk of obesity or whatnot.
Yep.
So I'm not saying there's no place for them. Do they have some issues? Obviously, I think anything made in a factory is probably not good for you if you're eating it. So if that is your treat, once a week you have a can of soda with diet sweetener. I mean, I'd rather have you have a can of diet Coke than regular Coke. I'd rather have you have neither.
Sure.
But if you absolutely have to have one and you don't, you're going to lose your mind, or there's going to be some other thing you're going to do, start smoking cigarettes or something. Everything is a balance.
Yep.
I'll leave it at that.
It's for me, the advice that I'll give is it's completely dependent on, as you said, its use. It comes down to how you individually are using artificial sweeteners, right?
Absolutely.
So if I see somebody and they're eating horribly and they come to me for advice, you know, and they show me what's going on, maybe for them, grading over from some of the sugars, the full-blown sugars, to artificial sweeteners makes sense, right? Because it still kind of hits that spot. It allows them to come down from, you know, such horrible heights. But then let's fast forward a year. Maybe the same person is now a totally changed person, right? They've lost a lot of weight. They're starting to feel good. Their mind is much more open to positive nutrition than ever before. Maybe now the very same artificial sweetener that helped them is now a crutch and Absolutely. Can be halved, you know? So it's all a process.
Yep.
How are you using it? Are you using it to get over and get past foods that are really, really horrible for you? Or are you using it as a crutch and you need to kick that crutch out?
Absolutely. My final comment on these, you know, last week we did see the mouse study where these mice chose saccharin over cocaine. So anything that's going to promote addictive behaviors in myself, I avoid.
And it's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, this is right along those lines. And the other thing is, every food that I eat, I make sure that it doesn't make me feel like crap afterwards. And frankly, maybe it's in my head, literally and figuratively, but when I drink like a Diet Coke, I get a headache. I don't feel well at all. And to me, that says my body's not liking this, and I avoid. And my last comment, I used to actually drink a decent amount of soda in college.
Yep.
When I stayed up late studying.
Yep.
And I absolutely got myself off of it by switching to bottled soda water.
Yeah. 'Cause
I found that I just needed something to kind of sip on. I liked the fizziness of it. And I switched myself onto that with the goal in mind of tapering myself off of that. And it was successfully done. And I actually have a couple other friends who did the same thing as well. So for those of you out there that are trying to get off the soda, off the sweetener, off the juice, that's one way to do it. Especially if it's not just artificial sweeteners, if it's these diet sodas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the idea of a carbonated club soda with no additives, and then taking, let's say, a half of a lemon or half of a lime and just squeezing that juice in there. Yep. You know, that's a pretty refreshing beverage. Yeah.
Get in a glass bottle too, no plastic.
All right. Now you've gone too far.
Now we're over the edge.
Now we're losing people.
The listeners are turning it off. All right. So moving on here, what do you got?
All right. I have a recent New York Times article, The Unproven Claims of Fitness Products. So I think this is going to hit home with many. And if it doesn't hit home, hopefully open a few eyes. So this is coming out of the University of Oxford, Dr. Matthew Thompson and his colleagues. They examined advertising for sports drinks, oral supplements, footwear, clothing, and devices like wristbands and compression stockings in 100 general interest magazines in 100 general interest magazines and the top 10 sports and fitness magazines in Britain and the US. So this is a pretty comprehensive, you know, looking all over the place, high and low, for companies that were making claims on the benefits of their products. So they went through these ads, the references that were used in these ads. They went back to these companies' websites, the references behind their websites. And then for a lot of these companies, they reached out to them and got some more responses. Wow. On the fundamental basis for these products. Quote, these researchers found not a single one that could be supported by rigorous scientific research. Moreover, the few fitness products that had been thoroughly evaluated appear to have no effect on strength, endurance, speed, or reduced muscle fatigue. So, wow.
Nice.
First of all, they found that most of the studies being used were low quality, were biased. I mean, for some of us, this is surprise, surprise. But for others, I mean, hey, these are ads in very popular magazines that you're used to seeing on a daily, you know, probably a daily basis or at least a weekly basis, that probably look very, very good and are well funded. So one used a study from one source to study from 1930, one supporting a Coca-Cola product used studies that were given unrestricted grants by Coca-Cola themselves.
No way. Surprise, surprise. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, conclusion, a lot of companies out there are making claims that are way too strong for the studies that do or don't underlie them. And you should be very, very skeptical when you see an ad claiming that something is the latest and greatest or the next, you know, magic pill.
Yep. Even Gatorade, they talked about Gatorade, Powerade in there. Throw it out.
Yeah.
Instead, buy Rogers Bone Broth, which will be for sale soon.
I'll never be taking that to market.
It is the salt in those drinks that's actually what you need, for the record.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good stuff, man. Good stuff, because these products are all around us. And a lot of times people spend money on these thinking they're being proactive.
Yeah, I mean, you can just think about acai berry. Mm-hmm. You know that?
Acai berry, yeah.
Acai berry. Oh, man. I mean, that was all over the place for the longest time. I remember even, I think, someone in Marissa's family, you know, we went back to spend some time with them, and they had some acai berry supplement lying around, and it's just, it got to be all over the place because these ads were all over the place, and it was purported to have all these amazing benefits. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. It falls woefully short, and unfortunately it creates this vicious magic pill cycle where it's search for the next one, grab it, you know, take it, test it, and then it falls short. And then you search for the next one, search for the next one. And it becomes this game.
Yep. You know what is proven? Sounds just like that.
What's that?
The Maasai diet.
just because it rhymes with Maasai. Yeah.
Clinically proven to work over like thousands of years. I mean, what other evidence do you need?
Trivia question. What episode number will it be that we stop mentioning the Maasai diet?
Never.
I know.
It's never gone out of style. It's not going to be like a Cyberry.
It's going to take us till episode 63. We're going to find a way to work that into every single one of these.
Once we actually get to Africa.
That's right.
Along these lines, I wanted to present this with the sweeteners, but it just seemed so fitting to wait till Roger's discussion. My article here, the final article, the effect of artificial sweetener on insulin secretion. This is looking at acesulfame K. And this is a sweetener that is used in a lot of workout shakes. I see it all the time. And they say, you know, aspartame-free, saccharin-free. Well, they just have another one of the chemicals that they pump out
right
in there. And this study showed that it caused an increase in insulin secretion. And it was in a dose-dependent fashion. So this kind of puts us right back where we started. One of the big issues with carbohydrates is there result on insulin and its secretion? Well, you're taking away the carbs, you're not getting those in, but you're still secreting the insulin. So you're still going to get that blood sugar that drops. You're still going to get that stimulation and appetite. It's not going to work out well for you. And this article pretty much tells you why.
It's like replace one unpronounceable chemical with another.
Exactly.
Right. And that it's back to the game. It's back to the game of a lot of these unproven claims. It's, oh, is aspartame, is that the new devil? You know, okay, let's kick that out of the product. And let's replace it with, again, the next unpronounceable chemical that no one knows about, right?
Yeah,
so we'll
exactly.
say, okay, it doesn't contain this, so it's good, thumbs up. And then 5 years later, the next study comes out showing that the very thing they replaced it with also is detrimental. Surprise, surprise.
And they say not shown to be dangerous. Well, of course, it's a brand new chemical.
Yeah. And those claims aren't regulated anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but what I did want to mention that we had actually talked about before this is that these insulinogenic effects... So this is on the show, kind of similar. Episode one, we had a phone call in Relentless Fitness Studio. Now we're at Colin's, and Colin has received a page.
I'm on call. I apologize.
So we have promised not to edit this show, and damn it, we're not starting now.
We're not. No, I'll wait to call them back.
Let's fight right through that page.
We're rounding it off here.
So what I did want to bring up that we had talked about is the insulinogenic effects, right, could be okay. If within a workout, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're using a protein shake, within the context of a workout or immediately following a workout, insulin sensitivity is going to be high anyway.
Yeah. It's an anabolic hormone. It might increase your ability to stimulate some muscle synthesis, et cetera.
That's why around a workout, sometimes carbohydrates ain't all that bad.
Yeah.
Of course, if they're well sourced, we always want them to be well sourced, but even the people using it well, right? Using it surrounding a workout, they might have a shake at night. They might have a second shake at night. They might have a second shake in the morning, something like that. And it could absolutely be messing with them at those points in time. So I think if you're using it perfectly right around a workout, maybe not all that bad. But if you're using it at any other time of the day, be wary.
I agree.
Sound good?
Sounds good.
Are you good to continue? Do you need to handle the page?
I may. So why don't you go on with your tangible takeaways?
Dude, go to it.
All right.
Tangible takeaway. This is a little weird. This is strange. But I will do my best to pick up this torch. Exercise takeaway. Washington Square Park is a park in Philly that I frequent. And a lot of times when I'm talking to a client about how to weave sprints into their life, I'll send them out to Washington Square. So for wherever you are as a listener, whether it be Philadelphia or beyond, if you can find a park or a square that's basically a block by a block by a block by a block. It's the perfect setup for a sprint interval routine. So especially if you've never had any exposure to sprints before. So I would recommend heading out to this square, starting at one corner, taking either a brisk walk or a light jog around the square until you feel good and warmed up. So that might be one lap, depending upon how long your city blocks are. That might be one lap around. That might be 2 to 3 laps around, if they're a little bit shorter. But the easiest way to start getting into sprints is after you're warmed up, start with a moderate intensity sprint. So take it about 50 to 75% and run from one corner of the square to the next corner of the square, right? Then slow it down to a brisk walk. Walk from that corner to the next corner. Then ramp it up. Now you're at, let's say, 70 to 80% of your intensity. Run to the next corner. Then slow it down, brisk walk. And you can kind of see where I'm going with this. So you're going to be alternating big time sprint and low level brisk walk, or maybe tops, maybe at tops, a light jog. You'll eventually work your sprints up to, you know, as close to 100% capacity as you can go, and then right about the time you fail to beat your last sprint. So in other words, let's say it's sprint number 5 and you complete it from corner to corner in 23 seconds. And then your next sprint, you complete it from corner to corner in 29 seconds, right? Appreciably different, appreciably slower. It's probably time to stop your workout. So keep rocking and rolling. Get up to about 100% intensity. That should be right around sprint 3 or 4. Then keep beating yourself as many times as possible. That probably caps out right around sprint 6 or 7. And then it is time for your workout to be over. And if you've followed me so far, I know it's been a long winding description of this, but if you followed me so far, the workout in all should be about 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes with a cool down and a little bit of stretching. So we're not talking about a huge time commitment, just to test out this sprint idea that we've put out there. You're back.
I'm back. It was an emergency situation, but I told them how dare they interrupt
the podcast.
I
have no idea. I had no idea how awkward it would be saying my piece without looking at you. You were gone and my mind just started blanking.
I heard you in the other room. I heard sprinting in park, so I agree with everything you said.
Yeah. Sprint around a park.
Yes. Sounds good. Caveman sprint. my takeaway here for exercise is, I'll be brief, is push yourself. I did an experiment with myself in the last 2 weeks in the gym. And for those of you that know, I'm really into weightlifting. I push a lot of weights, heavy weights, probably a little too much, and I might pay for that in the future. But
it's all about that pool in Pittsburgh, man. I feel like you have that in your head.
Got to look good for the pool. So I did an experiment where all of my lifts in the entire gym, I just increased by 10 pounds. And bench press, I increased by 20 pounds because 10 pounds each side. And you know what? I just wanted to see what would happen. I figured it's enough weight where it's still controlled. I have a spotter. And I actually got all the reps. My rep numbers stayed the same. They didn't even drop. And after those sets, I felt a lot more tired, a couple times a little nauseated. And it just showed to me that, you know, sometimes I think I'm really pushing myself in the gym and I'm not.
Yep.
And there's a fine line. You know, those 10 pounds made a difference between me, what I felt like really working out and then pushing it to the extreme. But if you think about it, you cut that down 10 pounds in the negative, which I think a lot of people do. And there's a fine line between you're not working out very much at all and actually getting something done in the gym. And it just made me really realize that I need to totally always push to push myself to the limit.
That's a great point. And not everyone, and there was a point where I didn't at all, not everyone understands the term intensity, you know, and mm-hmm. I think it's a process. I think that's why if you are grading into sprinting, you know, maybe you're not starting out at 100% sprints. You know, maybe it takes you a while to build up to that, right? It's all about understanding what intensity means to you and also being comfortable pushing your body to mm-hmm. that level. You know, if you're used to pushing yourself to 40 to 50% and that's it, you know, even trying to get to 80, 90, 100% is ridiculous. You know what I mean? That's a huge, huge leap and that might scare you off. So it's just starting to wrap your head around this idea of pushing yourself a little bit harder than before if you're at 50%, seeing what 55 or 60% means, you know,
absolutely.
And then seeing what 70% means. And then one day, maybe you're ready to really rip and roar and sprint all out.
Absolutely. Diet. What do you got?
Yeah, I got a real simple one today. So you talked about protein powder a little bit, and the insulinogenic effects of it. The right time for it may be during or after a workout if you are going to consume it. And so every now and again, when I do consume protein powder, I don't do it every workout, but occasionally I will bring in a very simple whey protein with not too many ingredients in there. I try and take out as many of the chemicals as possible, and I will mix it with regular coconut water. And so it will be a protein coconut water concoction. The coconut water is going to give me some sugar, which around a workout is something I actually want, you know, in a controlled amount, not going crazy with it. The protein is, again, well-timed. So
nice.
I've enjoyed that combo and try it out. If you're used to it, you know, I'm not saying, hey, introduce a protein product if you're not used to it, but if you're already consuming something like whey protein in conjunction with your workout, you might want to give it a shot. I actually have had some good experience sipping on it during the workout and then polishing the rest off afterwards. What about you? Do you use whey protein surrounding your workouts?
I do. It's one of my guilty pleasures. I've been doing a whey isolate.
Mm-hmm.
I push for no GMO products.
Actually, explain that for a second. Explain the whey isolate.
So a lot of these shakes have casein in them. Some push for whey.
Yep.
Some are a mixture. Casein's inflammatory. Some other issues as well. Slower digesting. That's why people used to push it. I don't know if a lot. Some still do. I've seen it in shakes. But mostly it's a whey discussion now. And just make sure it's a good isolated whey. I actually do mostly unsweetened, and I add some fruit in.
Yep.
And no soy lecithin, because it's often GMO, genetic modified. So that's my craziness.
Watch out for. So isolate is something to look for. You want that, right?
Yeah.
Soy lecithin, something to look for in the ingredient panel. You don't want that if possible.
And avoid those shakes that have all these other creatine, probiotics, all these other things. They're just going to rip you off. They mark the price up so much to put those other chemicals in, and they're dirt cheap. I mean, I make a lot of my own shakes straight from the factory, and they're not that expensive. And
these
people that are charging you an arm and a leg from are ripping you off.
Yep. So a lot of times it's just a branding thing, right? They'll basically get a private label company to produce basic protein powder and these basic add-ons, and they'll pay, you know, very small percentage of what they're charging. And then what the company's actually doing is they're just taking this private label substance that they didn't make and slaps their branding on it and then presents it to you in your living room.
Yeah.
So again, we're tearing down some walls here. I feel jaded today, man. I feel like I want to right all the wrongs in the world.
It is a negative day, but if you do want to right the wrongs in the world, one way is adding ghee to your diet.
There you go.
GHEE. It's clarified butter. You get it from grass-fed cows. It's nice golden color. So that's how you kind of know about that. I get an organic grass-fed ghee. It is easy to store. You throw it in your cupboard. It is very stable, solid at room temperature, unlike those vegetable oils and whatever else. It is absolutely delicious. I mean, it tastes like butter that you dip lobster in. It's great. Great for you. And that's my big thing. Throw it in your food, add some flavor in as well. And it is just so easy to store. You don't have to worry about butter going bad in your fridge.
So what ghee is it's, just to clarify, it's taking, so grass-fed ghee is taking grass-fed butter and straining out the milk proteins.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone has a reaction to milk, even though they're less likely to have it to butter, there's still a little bit of milk protein in there, and so they still could have an adverse reaction to butter. So ghee kind of takes it all the way, removes everything, and then leaves you with just full fat, which most people aren't going to have a reaction to.
Yeah, just a reaction of pure delight.
Joy.
Yes, that is the only reaction.
And what would you say to those out there who think, ghee, that is disgusting, that's going to clog my arteries? I know we've been down this road before, I just want a snap response.
That'll clog your arteries as much as butter, coconut oil, coconut fat, macadamia oil, macadamia nuts, or any of those other products will. And that's not much. So, I'm not really worried about it. I've looked through the data. It's full of holes.
Yep.
And we could go on about that for hours on end. But if your insulin's low, I wouldn't worry about it very much.
Yep. Sounds good. Especially, yeah, especially if you are, if you've adopted a low to moderate carbohydrate approach.
Yep.
And you're sourcing your food well, you have not too much to worry about there.
I agree.
Although if your carbohydrates are jacked through the roof.
Yeah, it's a different story.
It's a different story. So
relentless report.
Hopefully we're fixing that first, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't even go there.
Yeah.
Relentless report, buddy. What do you got for us?
Relentless report. Okay. So last week we had talked about, one of the last two weeks we talked about replacing, I don't have the time for that with, I don't have the life for that. And again, that came through trainer Nate Green. And I think it's a really, really great statement to start adopting. You know, do you really not have time to cook tonight, to cook a healthy meal tonight? Or is that because you spent 45 minutes on Facebook and email and, you know, a half hour watching a TV show? You know, where are your priorities, right? It's just getting, it's helping you get your priorities right. So I want to take that, and present a real life example. Had a client recently, love him to death, great, great client, but, he was having some problems with planning. He runs, super busy guy, always running around, lots to do. And he would get himself in these situations where, let's say it was 3 p.m, he hadn't eaten breakfast, he hadn't had a chance to get lunch, and he's literally starving, right? So his body and mind are basically panicking at that stage. And it would cause him to reach out for crap, just stuff that we wouldn't want, and stuff that he would regret later. So I was seeing this happen over and over and over again. And what I said to him, and to any of you out there who this is resonating with, you owe yourself 2 minutes the day before to just real quick think about the next day. Even if it's just the night before, think about the next day and think, all right, I'm busy. I have to be all over the place. Tomorrow is especially tough. Between the hours of 9 and 5, I'm going to be at this all day conference without a chance to have any access to good food. I know that the conference is probably going to source in, you know, subs and cookies, and they're going to call it a day. And I don't want to go down that road. So what do? Plan. If you just take those 2 minutes to plan the night before, maybe you wake up 10 extra minutes early, you get a huge, filling, amazing breakfast down the hatch, and you take a small snack or two with you, allows you to push through that conference, and then you load up with a big dinner, right? Alternatively, maybe it's on the road. Maybe you find a location around the conference that you can real quick pop out to during the lunch break and get a good solid lunch in. You know, whatever the strategy is you adopt, it doesn't matter, right? It's just that you've thought it through. You know it's going to be a problem. You plan around it. And guess what? That night after that conference, you're going to thank yourself. So again, no matter how busy you are, you owe yourself 2 minutes the night before to plan for the next day, and it will erase so much dissatisfaction and regret that will come after the fact of stopping off at, you know, the rest stop McDonald's at 4 p.m.
It'll help you out more so in the future. It will keep accelerating the process. You'll feel better over the long run. One thing I love to do is keep in mind that I'm not the only busy person out there. When I want to make an excuse that I'm too busy, I know two nights ago, reading up on Keith Norris's site, which I think is great. I love it. And I'm looking and I'm like, yeah, this guy's probably busier than me. I can't really complain. Because this week I've just been running around at work, and I have been skimping on lunch or skimping on my food and then feeling terrible later on. I'm just like, what am I doing? I'm not that busy.
Yep.
And to see his blog, his site, it was just like, oh, this makes me feel pretty good. So keep that in mind. Caveman Corner.
Well, and just to real quick,
that's back.
I just wanted to shout, again, the name you brought up, Keith Norris. He's from ancestralmomentum.com. And he is a guy who, you know, manages a studio, has a family, is running all over the place, training lots and lots of sessions, which I definitely can commiserate with. But again, we're not even the busiest people.
Yeah.
You know, there are people even busier than that are taking care of what they need to take care of to lead healthy lives. So doesn't matter where you fall on the spectrum, whether you're working 10 hours a week, whether you're working 90 hours a week, health has got to be your priority.
Absolutely.
Because if health is your priority, then guess what? You're going to function better at work. are you a business owner? You're going to, you know, you're going to kill it if you're feeling healthy and good every day.
Absolutely.
So make that your number one priority.
Caveman Corner.
Let's do it. Sound effect insert here.
My takeaway here is a quick one. ALARA, A-L-A-R-A. It's a principle we use in radiation. It's called as low as...
Not to be confused with the LARA bar.
No, not. There will be no talk on that. as low as reasonably achievable. And what this is basically to give you a quick antidote. It's we have these linear accelerators. They give off radiation. If we put 15 feet of concrete around them, no one would get any radiation. But it's not feasible. Financially, it's just not... There's many issues. So they basically make them a certain width. They put some lead in, and they know very well that radiation gets out. And it's a small amount. And it probably is going to cause some kind of damage. But the principle is as low as reasonably achievable. And I think it would make a lot of sense for us to look at other things that we encounter, like the sweeteners that we discussed. If you can eliminate them, as low as reasonably achievable there is just none. And if you can do that, great. If you cannot do that and stay sane, then you got to know yourself and you got to figure out a level. And this applies to plastics with me because I'm obviously crazy. And, you know, I think for me, having a water filter makes sense. A lot of other people say that's nuts and don't do it. And that's fine. You got to figure out what you can do and stay sane.
I like that a lot.
That is my,
And that really does apply everywhere, you know, applies to the exercise space. It applies to, you know, like you said, plastics and sweeteners. And I mean, you can go down that line of logic for everything. It's just figuring out what makes sense for you in your world, in your unique circumstance.
Yeah. And wheat and sugar, I know that I can't eat it. My, that has to be as low as possible. Cause if I eat a little, it's
the same way.
Yeah.
Like we talked about the other week, if that cookie is introduced, then, you know, a dozen are going down the hatch.
Exactly.
So it's better for me and for you to not even have that first cookie.
So keep that in mind.
That's right.
I think we did it.
I think that does it for episode 11.
Episode 11. I hope you enjoyed it. Everyone have a good week.
Definitely. So hey, for Dr. Champ, you can check him out on cavemandoctor.com. Grab the episode, drop a comment, say hi to him. You can find me on rogerdickerman.com. Grab the episode, drop me a comment and say hi. And as always, we are on iTunes, so check us out there as well. See you next week for episode 12.
Have a good one.